After the secret war in Laos, Lapongla Kitakaisi and his family fled their Hmong village in the mountains and were resettled on the Great Plains of America. The family adapted to life in Kansas, but would try to reconnect with their Highland roots by vacationing in the Rocky Mountains. Lapong eventually headed to New York City, exploring American counterculture, finishing college, and working his way up the corporate ladder. On September 11, 2001, he narrowly escaped the attack on the World Trade Center that left nearly 3,000 people dead. Shortly after that, Lapong walked away from city life, literally, by hiking his way across America. Having logged over 48,000 miles, he's seen some of America's most beautiful scenery, faced danger, and met some interesting characters along the way, but most importantly, remembers that Hmong means free.
Now, that last name, is that has a Laotian tone to it?
It's a Hmong name, and so it's actually my great-great-grandfather's first name, and I'm Hmong Lo, but the Kitakaisi name is used by just my great-great-grandfather's line, and it was kind of a way to distinguish us from the Lore clan.
Okay, that makes sense, because we're so used to the clan names, Lore, Song, you know, Bang, right?
Sure.
And we saw yours and said, that looks like a Lao name.
Yeah.
Hey, this is Coach Andetka. Welcome to another episode of C4 Podcast, Southeast Asian Athlete Achievement Through Adversity. We also, as you know, myself and John, my co-host, also run the LASHOF, Lao American Sports Hall of Fame, which I think it's great because it's bringing awareness to the achievements, you know, that our community is doing, like, you know, the great things that we're doing. And we decided to take it a step further and do a podcast, you know, to expand it a little bit more to Southeast Asia, but to talk about the adversity that our athletes, and sometimes it's just a great story, you know, we don't necessarily have to be, there have been people that haven't really been, you know, some that haven't been athletes, but their story was just amazing, you know, and this next individual, which John will introduce, he has a very great story. So, John?
Yeah, so Lapong, thank you so much for coming on the show. We're going to call you LP for short, and I'm going to let you pronounce your name to everybody so that we make sure we get it correctly. But we're excited to have you on because, you know, we've been covering stories of athletes and other individuals that are really inspiring and motivational. And you've got one of the best stories out there that we've seen. You know, it starts at the very beginning where you face a lot of adversity, you overcome it throughout your life. And most importantly, you find your passion, you chase it, and you're really living your dream, which is inspirational to me. So go ahead and introduce yourself. And really, we'd love for you to start at the beginning. Tell us about your life, you know, in Asia before you came to the U.S. and your parents' journey out of Laos.
Yeah, sure. So thank you for having me on. My name is Lapongla Kitakaisi. I go by LP as a nickname. And I'm sure we'll get into this later, but on trail, I'm known as Little Buddha. And I am Hmong, originally from Laos. My family came to the United States in 1976. My father and really my extended family were all part of the secret war in Laos. The Hmong were recruited by the CIA to really fight a covert war, along with many Laotian as well. And so when the United States pulled out in 75, 76, a lot of the military families were brought over through sponsorships, through either church organizations or directly through the military themselves. And our family was pretty fortunate in that because although we did end up in a refugee camp where I was born, my father was educated, went to college and had a lot of connections, but was also pretty high up in the military. And so we had it pretty easy, although still very challenging because of those two things. And so, yeah, we came here. I grew up in Kansas. The community really kind of came together and really helped our family with education and with really setting my parents up for success here in America. They helped us with education, with job placement, and then we were all put into school pretty immediately. I was a very young baby when we first came here. I was born in Naphung, Thailand, which was a refugee camp. It's also the my namesake. And so when I came over, I was a few months old. I had it relatively easy, I think, compared to my brothers and sisters who had to learn a whole new language and a whole new culture, as well as my parents who had to also learn an entirely foreign culture to them.
That's very, very similar to my story. We came over, my father was in the military. We came over in 75. And I know before that he had come to Kansas to do some educational stuff. But for some odd reason, we ended up in Ohio. So, but when we came over in 75, I was four. So I'm a few years older than you. But that's very, very similar, you know, having the military can kind of getting that first word of when you got to go and getting help, you know, knowing people over here. It's just, you know, but yeah, our sponsor just happened to be from Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. And we've got the similarity in hair too. So a lot of similarities, you meet.
Sure.
Yeah, that's for sure. And yeah, that story is very common. Even my wife's family came over in a similar fashion. I was just talking to my wife's uncle over the weekend. Actually, he was telling me his story. He was a pilot in the, I guess, the Lao Air Force. And of course, after things collapsed, that meant you had to kind of get out of there. And so he headed to the refugee camp as well. And here we all are talking about this in America, but Kansas of all places, right? It's flat. You guys are from the mountains. It's cold. You guys are from the tropics. How did your parents adapt to just the climate and that kind of, and the, just the differences?
I think it was a big challenge for them. You know, the Midwest and Kansas in particular, it's beautiful in its own way, you know, the open space and just the endless sky. And there's nothing more beautiful than a Kansas thunderstorm. And so I think my parents certainly appreciated that. I think what really connected them to the physical land in Kansas is because we're pretty passionate about like growing our own crops and, you know, having livestock. Those are important to our culture. And so that, I think, was a way for them to help them assimilate, right? But it wasn't really until we started visiting Colorado where my extended family settled. And so, you know, just to back up, I mean, the reason why we came to Kansas is because of the United Methodist Church in Hutchinson, Kansas, sponsored our family. And then there was also some military assistance there as well. And so while the community came together and my family started to form really a community with other Laos and Hmong people in the area, because there were a couple of families, not many, but one or two, right? It wasn't really until we started visiting my extended family in Colorado that I think my family, and especially my parents, started to feel like America was their home, because the Rocky Mountains are very reminiscent of some of the mountains that they came from. And so I have very vivid memories of my father and my mother and my entire extended family backpacking and camping, fishing, hiking up in the Colorado Mountains. And I just remember the joy that that brought to my dad, especially, and also to my uncles, who, again, grew up in Laos in this mountainous, beautiful area. So I think it was an adjustment for my father and my mother. But they decided to stay in Kansas because it was safe for them. In the 80s and early 90s, there was a lot of in the larger cities in the community, unfortunately, there was a lot of gang activities. And so my parents saw that and knew that if they were to relocate, that their young children, sons might be recruited into that, because we were seeing how some of our extended cousins were being really pressured, right? And my mom and dad did not want that for us. And so they purposely, which is very not Hmong, decided to stay away from the community and stay isolated in Hutchinson, Kansas.
Hmm. Well, very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. We were brought over by the Lutheran church, but I think being in Ohio, there weren't any families. So we decided, that's how we decided on Chicago.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting because my wife's family, the same thing, they came with sponsors and some of her uncles came with sponsors to Illinois. And my wife's family left to go to Amarillo, Texas. And then you kind of lost the support of your sponsor. You know, so much like you had all that support, her uncle that stayed here had, you know, they made sure he knew English, they helped him get a good job, right? But if you left kind of that initial settlement point, you were on your own, is kind of how it would work. But yeah, they had to make tough decisions, right?
Right.
Do you follow your family and go to bigger cities, or do you kind of stay in where you feel safe and that? And I think it's worked out for you overall, and they made a decision overall. But so you kind of, is that how you initially got into hiking, those trips to the Rockies?
Absolutely. You know, I have really early childhood memories when I was 3-4 of being up in the mountains. And it was really on those trips that I learned all of my backpacking and camping skills, fishing as well, and hunting, you know, and all these skills that I still use today. My uncle and my parents taught me. It's kind of, when I think back and about it now, it was really early on when I started to meet, actually. So the sport that I participate in, it's called thru hiking, long distance hiking. And I'm sure we'll get into that. But I just remember on like this particular time when we were up there backpacking and camping, we came across this very, he was a wild looking man. I mean, he had long hair. He was Caucasian and carrying this enormous backpack. And I just remember, I must have been maybe 8 or 9, no older than 10. But I just remember being curious about this person because he had claimed that he had hiked from Mexico. And I remember that so vividly. And it turned out later that he was really the first thru-hiker I had ever met. But he was going from campsite to campsite asking for a ride into town, because when you're through hiking or long distance hiking or even bike packing, oftentimes you need help from the community. You hitchhike into town to resupply. And that's what this guy was doing. And so he was just wandering around from campsite to campsite. And so as this young, impressionable Hmong immigrant child, I just had this very vivid memory of this tall white guy with a really long beard needing a ride. And I rode down with my uncle. I was like, oh, this guy might have a story or something interesting to talk about. And, you know, I don't remember a lot about the conversation, but I remember how he smelled, which was terrible. And that was really the first time I ever, now looking back on it, met a long distance thru hiker. And I think I've always carried that memory with me. And so somewhere, you know, up in the mountains, that's where the seed of like wondering and wanting to get out there, really, it was because of this gentleman and this happen chance experience, really.
Yeah, that's incredible. I don't think my family would have given them that ride. it's like something right out of a horror movie, right? Or whatever.
So. You know, it was the 80s, so it was, you know, a different time.
Yeah.
So it was just different, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. Well then, so, you know, you got into hiking, but at the same time you went to college, mm-hmm. right? And I went to college engineering, but I know folks in the marketing side and finance side, right? To land a job and go to like Manhattan was the dream, right? The gold standard. If you did it, you made it. You landed that opportunity. So tell us a little bit about college and going to Manhattan for that marketing job.
Yeah, sure. So I had an extended college career is the way I like to explain it. I was a pretty adventurous kid, and I want to preface all this because it impacts on how I got to New York. You know, I started going to the University of Kansas, right? And in my second year, I was a camp counselor out at Chile, Colorado camps in Colorado. And
You know, as a young, impressionable child in the middle of Kansas, I didn't really have a lot of cultural influences, but I did a lot of reading. And so there were a couple of books that were really instrumental into kind of sparking this idea that there might be a life outside of what I knew in Kansas. And I just remember reading Jack Kerouac's On the Road at a very young age and just really being inspired to kind of like start thinking that, you know, there's a lot more out there than this little town, my life in Kansas, you know, all these characters that Jack Kerouac talks about meeting on the road. And so that book was very fundamental in my development, but also books like A Thousand Mile Walk to the Gulf by John Muir. It's really one of the first thru-hiking books I ever read. But in addition to just the books that I was reading, there were also a lot of cultural kind of counterculture influences. So I was a big Andy Warhol fan, and this idea of the whole factory and like you could be in a big city and just be different really appealed to me as an impressionable young child. And so I bring these up because the way I got to New York was this. I just was in my second year at KU, and I was like, I'm going to just go to New York. You know, the summer before, I had hitchhiked from Colorado out to California. I was 19, and I hiked the John Muir Trail. And I just did it kind of on a whim. I was like, I'm just going to do it. And so sitting in at KU in my second semester, I was just like, you know, I think I'm just going to move to New York. I'm just going to do it, and I'm just going to figure it out when I get there. And so I got to the city. I met all these characters that Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg talked about, you know, and I kind of fell into this whole, it's basically the club kid scene. And that was really kind of eye-opening to me as well. And I had to get a job. And so I got a job as an assistant, right, at American Express. And I also, in that time, started going to college night classes at the University of CUNY, City University of New York. And that's how I started really working at American Express, right? And I just worked my way up from an assistant to eventually a business manager to eventually leading my own product line within American Express. And that happened relatively quickly within 4 years while I was there. So that's how I got to New York. It's not the traditional, you know, graduate college and then they come and recruit you. It was none of that. It was all hard work from the beginning.
You're not a traditional Asian fella, you know, like very, you know, like just trying to survive. Like, again, like I hated reading. I hated reading. So, you know, you take an interest in reading and even like hiking and stuff. I don't know. It was just like when you did the first trek to California, was that just you by yourself or did you?
It was.
That's amazing. It's amazing.
I think I've always been attracted to kind of fringe parts of our society. I've always been like that. I've never felt like I fit in anywhere except outside in the woods.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I found as a person with an intersectional identity, so I belong to many different groups, not just my Hmong group, right? And my Hmong ethnicity and my immigrant status. I mean, I'm a creative. I'm an artist. I read. You know, I write. But I'm also very interested in the world, and I've always been that way. I've been very curious as a child. You know, so early on, you know, It's not that I wasn't happy. It's just I knew there was more to my life in Kansas, and I was too young, obviously, to travel as a younger teen. So the way I traveled was through books, and, you know, and that's how I was exposed to the Beatniks. That's how I was exposed to Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac, and obviously to all the artists that really inspired me. And so that really was part of my growing up and fundamentally influenced how and who I am today.
So I got to ask, what kind of music did you like, given your your background.
Yeah, so I did like punk music, but it's not going to be the screaming punk that you're thinking. I was a big fan of Patti Smith. And, she, to me, is just such a great singer-songwriter, but her punk actually had layers to it. And, she's the godmother of punk, right? A lot of people don't. Well, no, I think people that are in punk know that Patti Smith is punk, but I think to a lot of the younger people, they just are like, yeah, she had a couple of good songs, but I might know her.
Was that the lead singer of Scandal? I'm thinking of Patti Smythe. Is there a Patti Smythe?
No, Patti Smith. Smith.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm thinking of Patti Smythe, yeah, and which I thought would have like was the same person, but I guess not.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, you're working at American Express. You're rising up the ranks. You're enjoying the city life in New York and all the interesting people that you meet. September 11th, 2001 comes along. Tell us about that day and what your experience was.
Well, it was just another day, every day. And I lived down in the West Village and took the train down into what was the World Trade Center Mall. It's a train station that was directly underneath the two towers. And, I remember the train just came to a really, a very abrupt screeching halt. And, things like that happen in New York quite often, unfortunately. Sometimes people get out on the tracks for whatever reasons. And so, that's just what I thought it was, but I quickly learned that it was something a lot more because the MTA, which is the train workers, came down and evacuated the train. And I unfortunately made the mistake of exiting right into the plaza, which was right in between the two twin towers. And the first plane had already struck the tower. So there was all this debris all over, lots of smoke. And as I was kind of just sitting there, trying to figure out what was going on, that's when the second plane hit. And then I was really just running for my life. I was decked out in work tires. So I, had these like dress shoes on and a tie and my computer bag strap over. But I remember running and I remember there was someone had been injured. This lady had been injured from the impact. There was a lot of people that were injured. A lot of, unfortunately, people that didn't make it that were just kind of lying there. But me and this guy somehow picked her up. We ran into this pizza shop and kind of just hid out for a while as all the debris was falling. And then the police came down and kind of started evacuating the area. And so, I left and walked back home. And that morning was all kind of a daze. It gives me chills even now when I talk about it because, I've never been able to kind of watch any movie or anything about September 11th. I've never watched a documentary. I understand that I'm actually in a documentary running and I've seen part of it. I don't know who was videotaping that day, but they were kind of just down there doing some kind of, they must have had a video recorder because obviously this is way before phones were around. And he had just videotaped like the crowds running and I'm in the crowd running. So anyway, it was just really traumatic for me. And it was traumatic for, I think, New Yorkers, for Americans. But I often say this, as traumatic as the experience is, what I take from that, and I think what a lot of New Yorkers and people that lived in the tri-state area take from that day, there was also a lot of kindness because in all that destruction, we have, I think, forgotten, unless you were there, that there were people that weren't able to get out of the city because all of the mass transit had completely closed down. And so you have all these people that live in the outer boroughs or people that live in New Jersey or upstate New York, and they can't get home. And, and I'm right down in the West Village, people are just kind of walking around. There are huge lines up on the West Side Highway. And me and my buddies, we were on our bikes and I just started offering people, I could only take in like five people. It was exactly five people into my apartment. Apartments in New York are very small. And so anyway, And it wasn't just me. I mean, I know all my neighbors did that. And I just remember how people in the tri-state area really came together and just supported each other and just tried to figure out what was going on. Yeah, those are the things I remember. And, you know, the bad stuff that happened, obviously that's going to always be seared in my memory. But what I choose to remember, actively remember and recall often, is that kindness and connection that happened. That's something that has inspired me and continues to inspire me today.
Yeah, that's amazing that you can look at it from that point of view. I mean, it affected the country, but I couldn't imagine, I don't know about you, John, but to be there. Like, I don't think I've ever talked to anybody that was there. I knew people that had family, or I had firefighter family, and I get like that, but never have I ever heard of someone that was, you know, there. So yeah, you're the first.
I mean, I was on the other side of the country in California, and it affected the whole country. But yeah, like what you guys went through right there on the ground, whole different level. But I love how, you know, you could always find the good in these things. You know, that just showed what Americans and people in general, right, are really all about, coming forth, helping each other, and doing what they can. And that's you know, incredible. So, you know, I know things after that, you know, you kind of went in a different direction after a little while and left New York. So tell us what kind of drove you to decide to give up that very successful corporate career and life you had built up.
Yeah, so I think it goes back to kind of my childhood memories of backpacking. And when I was younger, when I was 19, I mean, I wasn't much older, but I had hiked not only the John Muir Trail, but the year after I had done the Pacific Crest Trail also. And so I knew that there was a whole, again, I guess sometimes knowledge isn't a great thing. Sometimes experience is, when you've had these experiences that you know can offer happiness as well, it drives you into a different direction, which is, I think, a good thing in this case. But I already had a taste of thru hiking, so I knew it was already out there. And I knew about the other long trails. And I was working at American Express. I often say this, I was working like a doctor. I was working doctor hours, but not being paid like a doctor. I was sitting in my office on a Thursday. And I just remember, and this was after 9/11. And I just had this existential crisis. I was like, what am I doing? Right. You know, I'm happy. I'm not the type of person that believes in false choices. Like, I don't think that living in the city is better than being out in the country or vice versa. I can be happy in both places. And quite often I tell people I'm equally happy at 14,000 feet as I am in the middle of Manhattan, because I think both offer very similar experiences and can be paths to happiness. But on this particular day, I was not happy. I was overworked. September 11th was like 6 months had happened. And, you know, I basically was living in like a war zone, right? Everything under 23rd Street, you had to basically show your ID every time you traveled outside the neighborhood. It was a lot. And I was just like, you know, I'm not happy. I'm going to go and hike, you know, I mean, because that's where, you know, when I was younger, I just remember having these great experiences with my family. And the first two thru hikes I had done, I had really, really enjoyed it. And so I started it was a rather short process of just getting rid of all my belongings and donating what I couldn't sell, and really kind of deciding on what was important and what could fit in my backpack. And I left New York and I went to hike the Continental Divide Trail. And from then on, I've been able to, thankfully, figure out a way where I can pretty much stay on trail almost every year to every other year. You know, obviously I have to work, but it was a conscious decision to leave that lifestyle. And I haven't looked back since I since I left New York and started on the trail.
So explain how you do that. Like you, I mean, you're on a trail for 3 months and you come back home for a little bit. How's that work?
Well, and I want to say this because I know it's very privileged, because I'm very close to my family. And so, I don't have like a home, you know, I have a storage unit in San Francisco where I lived at one point. I have some old furniture in New York that I've given to some friends. And then I do have a car and, you know, my parents are kind enough to let me park my car at their house when I'm not hiking. But I don't have a lot of things, and that's how it works. People always ask, well, how are you able to do this? And the secret is very simple. You know, simplify, 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 right? Keep only those things that are important to you. And in my case, all my gear that I can use on trail. It's a very utilitarian way of looking at living. And so the way that I do it is I have these, I call them campaigns, because I often will go from long trail to long trail. So I'll hike one long trail, like the Continental Divide Trail, and then I'll do like the part of the Appalachian Trail or go on to the Florida Trail. And so basically how I do it is like this. Obviously I still work, even now I'm off trail technically. This year is an off trail work year. Because of my marketing background and sales background, I am able to consult, and I'm also able to work closely with businesses that just hire people that need to get things done. So like, for example, right now I'm working for a real estate investment company that my buddy runs. And he just basically needs like a business manager to really handle all the day-to-day operations. And so that's what I do. And so I'll take these gigs for 6 months and then I'll hike for 2 years. And I put everything into my hiking. I'm not a materialistic person. So I don't have the newest iPhone. I don't have the nicest car. I have like a 2011 Nissan Sentra with like 40,000 miles on it because I never drive it. So it's once you start kind of like parsing it out that way, it's actually very simple to live this lifestyle. And I'm also very fortunate because myself, I'm not married, I have no kids. And that's a very specific, probably to my parents' unapproving gaze, but I've made those conscious decisions because this is the lifestyle that I want to live.
Yeah, wow.
That's amazing, you know, for you to say, okay, you don't have much, but you have a lot. And what your experience and what you've seen in life is... Yeah, that's out there. You can't compare it to, you know, you are very, very, how can I say this?
Wealthy in a different way, maybe, right?
Yes, yeah.
And if you think
about it, he's very rich.
At the end of your life, yeah. The BMW you bought when you were 30 or 40 will be a bucket of rust in the junkyard. But what you have and what you've done will still be there and will be, you know, in your mind and part of what you left, you know, as far as your legacy. You know, and
maybe, you know, I'm just trying to be myself. You know, I think there have been other people a lot more interesting and thoughtful than myself that have kind of just said F you to the world and walked into the woods. I do a lot of speaking, especially to youth, and I always preface all my interactions and initial like conversations with like either teachers or with people that approach me and ask me to speak at their colleges or whatever. But I have a very specific point of view, and it might not be the best in terms of how you guys would, I guess, define success, because for me, success is about experience. And in that way, I'm a billionaire, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. But you know, when you first walked away from that job and you told your parents you're just hitting the road with no plan, what did they say? Or what did they think?
Yeah, it was very similar. Like when I told them I was moving to New York. And a funny story, you know, it's no secret. I really did not explain any of this to my parents when I first hitchhiked out to California. They didn't even know I did it until like 10 years later. And when I told them I was moving to New York, they were like, why would you move to New York? I've always just been that way. I'm a very adventurous person. And once I get an idea about an experience that I myself want to have, I go for it. And so when I left New York, you know, finally my parents were like, there's some stability in your life. You've been here for like 5-6 years, you know, going on now 9-10 years. Why would you leave? And I just told my parents, they just had to trust me. I'm, you know, it's not like the goals that I had in my life weren't necessarily the goals that they wanted me to have. And they would have to be okay with that. I think that's a very challenging thing for children of immigrants to really kind of rectify, because, you know, as a child of immigrants, we're always pressured to either become a doctor or a lawyer or something to be better than the generation before us because of the sacrifice that they did. And I certainly have always respected that. But I am not just a child of immigrants. I'm an American. And that has afforded me a certain perspective that I think that, you know, my parents' generation just don't have. And, you know, it's, I know that they were disappointed, but I think that the person that I am today has proven that the path that I decided to start walking in, the way that I started to live my life, they can appreciate now. They know how happy I am. They finally understand this whole idea of long distance hiking and through hiking. And they do know that I am a success in many different ways. And it's helped along the way that I've gotten sponsorships and companies have given me money, you know, to hike. Although I do fund most of my hikes personally myself, just because I don't like to be beholden to any kind of corporate brand. It kind of goes against what I'm about. So, you know, they do see that there are positives in this.
Yeah, that's good. So you've hiked, I mean, some incredible trails. You've had some exciting adventures, but at the same time, you're out there on your own. Mm. There's had to be some scary times too. Maybe tell us about some of those.
Scary times with people or with animals?
People, whatever. You yeah. Choose both.
Well, so I am a person of color, and I walk through this world as a person of color, and I, and that doesn't end when I go onto the trail. In fact, and many times it can amplify, you know, my otherness, my brownness. And unfortunately, there are still parts in the United States, in the world, that, you know, people like me that look like me, like us, are, you know, in harm's way out there, right? Like, there are prejudiced people in this world. That's just a fact. And so I have experienced racism out on trail, in particular in the South. There's some trails that, so long distance trails in general, most of them, I would say like 60% of them are complete, but that 40% is a lot of road walking. And so oftentimes you're walking through backcountry roads through small town America, and people have never seen someone like me, right? And not only have they never seen or interacted with a person like me, but I'm also carrying my entire world on my back. So I essentially look like an itinerant / homeless person. And in the South, especially in Florida, there's a large itinerant homeless population. And so people just assume that that's what you are. And so I have been in situations where people kind of threatened me and kind of got aggressive with me, but I've always been able to either A, diffuse the situation and lower the temperature. And then I get their curiosity. They're like, wow, you look a certain way, but you're from Kansas and you speak relatively good English. And you know, what is this about? And you have this backpack on. Where are you hiking from? To where? And so that, you know, so in those opportunities, because I look at those as opportunities, I see them as just curious people. And in that case, I'm always about education. I want the experience for, obviously for myself, I don't want to be hurt. And I want them to have a good positive experience with a person like me. And I can't tell you how many times that has happened on trail, where at first people were kind of threatening towards me, but then actually took the time to hear me out. And now they're my friends. Did they say the right thing? No. Did they say the wrong thing? Absolutely. Was I able to educate them? If it was safe, I was, right? If it wasn't, I just left the situation. And so there's that element out there. And I think any person of color that does long distance hiking in America across these small towns has very similar experiences. And so there's that element. Now, animals, I can say this, I've traveled in North America in polar bear country and grizzly country and alligator country. I've hiked right next to packs of wolves. I've heard mountain lions, never seen one, but I've heard them. They have a very specific scream, especially when they're in heat. Large animals generally will leave you alone. It's the small ones you have to worry about, like mosquitoes or ticks, some kind of, you know, disease or whatever that comes from that, from being getting bit by a tick, right? Snake bites, scorpion bites in the desert. And on country roads, the most dangerous animal besides a car and a human are people's dogs that they don't lock up. You know, I'm from Kansas. We don't lock up our dogs either, but there are some pretty vicious pit bulls / mixed breeds in the South. I don't want to say that all pit bulls are bad. We have had pit bulls in my life growing up. We've adopted pit bull strays, but there are some pretty vicious dogs down in the South. And so what I would say about that is that's really the only time I carry bear spray. I don't carry it for the bears. I carry it for people's loose dogs. And if I had to really protect myself from another person.
Yeah. And yeah, again, it's not that the pit bulls are bad. It's that if a poodle comes at you, a little toy poodle, all right, you could handle it. If a big pit bull or mixed breed type dog that's, you know, 150 pounds comes at you, you got a problem, right? That's the challenge.
Man. Oh yeah. Yeah.
I don't even like driving through the South. Maybe that might not be the right thing to say, but it's you can sense it. You can sense it as you're driving right through town, the looks that you get, and it's just, we're different, you know. I mean, you're American, but you're different, you know.
Right.
And unfortunately, that's how, you know, that's how it is.
But. Yeah. But I'll say I lived in California, the South, and now the Midwest. Well, first California, then Spartanburg, South Carolina. There are good people everywhere. There are bad people everywhere, right? And you know, Coast, I wouldn't be afraid. Spartanburg was a great experience for me. There's a large Lao community there. That everybody was friendly, right? Well, but yeah,
I think I mean like more like the Alabama, Mississippi type of
where
it's known, where it's well known and documented.
Oh yeah,
that there, you know, racism.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. Well, so you mentioned polar bear country. That's got my interest. Where did you hike that there are polar bears?
So I did a trail called. Kind of a funny story. I didn't even actually know I was in polar bear country, but I did a trail called the Eastern Continental Trail. And if you've heard of the Appalachian Trail, it's part of that. It goes from Key West up to Belle Island, Newfoundland, up in Canada. It's like 6,000 miles. But it was up there that there are polar bears, and I had no idea. And that's actually a very recent, I think, happening in the last 10 years. I first hiked the ECT in 2010, but I remember, you know, being on Newfoundland, and first of all, they're huge moose. I don't know how the moose, I think they swim across the strait there, and they might have imported some too, because I don't think they're endemic to that area, but the moose population there is huge. And at the very northern tip of Newfoundland, there is the occasional polar bear, but now I believe in the last 10, 12 years, there's actually an established population up there. And so I was up in polar bear country. I can say I camped up there, and, you know, I've hiked up in, the Canadian Rockies as well, you know, and they have huge grizzly bears up there, but yeah, that's where I encountered, or where I hiked in polar bear country without knowing it, and hope and thankfully did not encounter any polar bears.
Now, if you could, if somebody like say me and Co could do one thru hike and one thru hike only, what would you, what is the absolute best trail?
How much time do you have on
that? I don't know, a month.
Okay. Yeah. So, so that, that informs the conversation, because some of the longer trails like the PCT and CDT, those are like 4 to 5, 6 months, right?
Oh, wow.
But with a month, I would go with something shorter, like the Tahoe Rim Trail is really nice. It's a couple hundred miles, and you could probably do it in a couple of weeks. I would really highly recommend that. California has great weather. You know, it's really unfortunate the last few seasons because of the fires up in that area. But those are very non-technical hikes that you could do that I think an intermediate slash beginner hiker could probably take on. Another hike that I always encourage people to look into, because, you know, everyone knows about the Appalachian Trail, but the Pinhoti Trail is actually an extension of the Appalachian Trail down into Alabama. We were just talking about Alabama, but it's about 200 and I think 75 miles. But the Pinhoti Trail is like this hidden gem of a of an experience, because there are, it has none of the crowds like the AT, and it has shelters and some of the best water that side of the Mississippi, beautiful waterfalls and vistas. So I highly recommend that if you've got, you know, a couple of weeks to a month, Tahoe Rim Trail, Pinhoti Trail.
That's awesome.
Man, I wouldn't want to do a road trip across the country, you know, doing like, I wouldn't like flying from Miami to LA, you know, that's too much for me. So, man, I commend you on what you do. I commend you on what you do.
Yeah.
So, and I tell you, if your story doesn't inspire someone, like, let's say of Asian descent to hike, it'll definitely inspire them to take a chance, you know, just go and do what your heart desires, right? I mean, that's what you've done. And that to me is the most inspirational part.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I think
it's very hard, right? I think it's hard in the Asian culture, right? Because we're taught to be safe, right? And my parents go to school, engineer, doctor, whatever, and you'll be safe, you know? Get married and have a kid, and you have kids and you'll be safe. And but for you to do the things, and it probably had a lot to do with you, you know, being so young and you know, hiking with your family. So.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my parents are the ones who are indirectly and directly responsible for who I am. You know, they were the first ones to take me out into the woods. My dad was raised me to be a very independent thinker. And, you know, I was afforded as a young kid to really kind of explore our small town, but also, you know, they encouraged us to go to the library, and that's where I started reading. So it's, you know, I mean, like, it's all because my parents themselves are adventurers in their own way and are risk takers in their own way. I mean, that's the only reason why we survived. And, you know, I have to say this, my backpacking through hiking, it's kind of like a love letter to Hmong culture, because I draw a lot of inspiration from my culture. You know, this connection, this idea of being connected to community is really about being connected to the earth and the land. And I certainly practice that when I'm out on trail, and I honor my forefathers, but really just practice my culture out there about appreciation for land and spirits. And, you know, for me, it's so much more than just getting out there and the athleticism of it. It's really about, I don't want to say communing with nature, because that's not right. It's about being at peace with myself in my sanctuary.
Oh, and Hmong, correct me if I'm wrong, it means free, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So you're right. living that for sure. You know, and like,
correct me if I'm wrong, I got one thing, John. When you had said, or maybe I'd heard, your mother was pregnant with you when she was crossing from Laos to Thailand, right?
Correct.
Wow, there you go. You were hiking back then.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we've, you know, John brings up a great point, you know, Hmong, and I think in Chinese and also other different languages, I mean, it literally translates to free, because our people have always been very independent and have always wanted to live our own ways and celebrate our own culture. And unfortunately, that has opened us up to being persecuted. So that spirit of freedom absolutely lives in me and always has.
So, you know, like Ko said, it's not, I mean, not everybody loves hiking like you. That's not their passion. But I think your story, your applies to people who want to pursue something, irregardless of what it is, whatever really makes them feel at peace. What advice would you have to somebody who's really like looking for that direction in life? And it hopefully it's not hitchhike and jump in a car, but you know, advice. That
hey, I mean, what I would say is this. I think there needs to be a rethinking of what success means. I've done unpacked this work for a very long time when I was very young. And don't be afraid to fail, because I have failed so many times before. Now, I've luckily, most through hikes that I've hiked, I've always been successful. I will say that. But that's through patience and practice and, you know, having hiked quite a bit of miles. But when I was very young, I was fearless. And I knew that there was a bigger world out there that I wanted to experience. And along the way, either whether it was my family or friends that were just really questioning the decisions I was making, and really questioning the lifestyle that I was living, I really started to unpack what success means for me. And through that work, I found happiness. And so that's what I would encourage people listening to this. Look at how we define success as a society, but more importantly, rethink how you define success, because I think that's where to start.
Yeah. Awesome advice, you know, but again, like the Asian culture, it's so much pressure to follow. Yeah. To follow the rules. But you were the youngest, right?
I was the youngest. Yeah.
I'm the youngest too. And I think the youngest, we can get away with a little more than
Well, I think they're just tired by the time they get to us.
Yes, exactly.
You know,
my dad just gave up, so I can't do this anymore. Just do whatever.
Yeah. I think so. Yeah. They were just tired. And I was I had all these big ideas as a kid, so it was hard to contain me.
That's awesome. Awesome you're able to see, you know, all that you've seen.
Yeah.
Very lucky. Yeah.
Yeah. So I know you go by Little Buddha, and that's where a lot of people could follow you. Tell us how you got that name and where people can find you on social media to follow your adventures.
Yeah, sure. So within through hiking, there's a way of getting a trail name, and Little Buddha is my trail name. And it was given to me on my very first through hike on the John Muir Trail by my trail dad. His trail name was Dharma. And I got it on top of Mount Whitney, actually, the last day of the John Muir Trail. I was just kind of sitting in a very comfortable position, which is Lotus. And Dharma just turned to me, and he was an older hiker. And he just said, "My God, you look just like a Little Buddha." And it just kind of stuck. And so that's my trail name. I've had it like for 27 years now. My God, when I actually say that, everything starts to calculate in my head what I've done. But you can find me mostly on my Instagram account. I post there, especially when I'm hiking, but it's a good way to get in contact with me. And if, you know, part of my hiking is about activism and nurturing and mentoring younger hikers and people that might be interested. So anyone can reach out to me. I will answer every question that you send to me, and I'm happy to provide my expertise, my, you know, if this is your first time getting into backpacking, I'm happy to offer advice.
Yeah, like I said, and I mean, it's not just the advice for hiking. It's you and you speak, right? So, I mean, you can obviously give advice on life in general, and being free, I think. Great. John, you got anything?
No, LP, we really appreciate it. You know, this was a great conversation. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
The C4 Podcast is brought to you by the Lao American Sports Hall of Fame. Visit us on the web at laoamericansports.com, celebrating the first, inspiring the next.